Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Does anyone notice anything different about my outfit?
Oh, you've got something on your head.
Yeah, not to go fishing, but do you like my hat?
An exotic bird.
I love your hat.
Can only be described as jaunty.
Especially in the context of the podcast studio, the hat is outstanding.
I've had to put my headphones on creatively because I'm feeling so envious of your hat.
I think you should wear those to Ascot.
Well, it could still be a range. I don't know if they're the right diameter.
It could be a promotion for the Fashion Unzip podcast.
It's a bit Scaparelli, you know.
It is.
I put them over my ears, people, now because I did look ridiculous.
Well, I have to say that even though we are at the Telegraph and we do have an image to maintain, hats are still not everyday accessories. I'm wearing one in honor of Royal Ascot, the Festival of Horse Racing, Champagne, and Hats.
I have to say, because Emily's American, this is like her doing English national costume.
Yes, it's a total novelty for me. I love it. So I'm Emily Cronin, and this is Fashion Unzipped. With me in the studio are Bethan Holt, Charlie Gowans-Eglinton, and back after some globetrotting in the name of fashion, Lisa Armstrong. Welcome back, Lisa.
Thank you.
Later in this episode, we're going to bring you the scoop on the Royal Ascot dress code, for which I'm obviously very well prepared, the starriest attendees, and how much this particularly British event is worth to the economy. But before we get there, we've got lots of other cultural ground to cover, starting with your best excuse to wear a flower crown this summer. On Saturday, a new must-see exhibition opened at London's Victoria and Albert Museum. Frida Kahlo, making herself up, puts the artist's costumes and personal effects on display alongside portraits and original artworks. Although Kahlo is one of the most prominent female artists in history, I think it's fair to say that this show still included some surprises. Lisa, you visited Casa Azul in Mexico City, and what do you make of what you saw and what you have gathered about what's going on in the show?
I haven't been to the V&A exhibition yet. I'm dying to go. But I think the thing about the Frida Kahlo, from what I've seen in the press so far, is that, you know, it's a very personal, intimate exhibition, and that's the kind of artist she was. She painted herself incessantly. She was kind of the Tracy Emin of her day. Going to her home was incredible because it was as if she had just got up this morning. You could almost see her imprint still on the bed. You know, her paintbrushes were still in the pots, all the furniture, the bed where she and Diego slept, the bed where Diego had to go and sleep when he was snoring, I think, and the kitchen where they'd painted lots of their utensils themselves. She's such a kind of Me Too kind of artist, isn't she? Because her pain is all out there and everybody can identify with her. Her travails seem very contemporary, you know, the body image, the style, the self-creation, the trouble with her, you know, having the miscarriage and being very open about it, the sort of the lesbian affairs, the flirtation with politics, and, you know, because Trotsky came to stay with them in Mexico. He may even have lived with them for a while with his wife. There's something for everyone there in the Frida Kahlo story.
She was really a confessional artist, but even knowing everything that we know, everything that she told us, I still found parts of the exhibition, which I know I'm the only one who's actually seen, but bear with me, quite harrowing. The early rooms have her medical corsets and some of her prostheses and cases of makeup and prescriptions and pain medication. And And there's even, you know, an excerpt from a note that she wrote to her doctor begging for more Demerol. And apparently he ripped up his prescription pad rather than succumb to giving her more.
Did seeing all that, her backstory, give you a greater appreciation of her art?
It did. I mean, so the way that the exhibition, the pace of the exhibition is such that you go down like a Majorelle blue hallway, or really a Casa Azul blue hallway, and it's the early life of Frida, you know, her family, putting everything into context. Then you get to the room with you know, the prosthetic leg, with the hot pink boot, and all of the medications and the corsets, and many of which she painted as a way to decorate, to make something decorative out of her pain. Then you're funneled through these tiny hallways into this not vast room, but the biggest room of the exhibition, where you actually see in the center this huge display of her costumes, and then along on the walls alongside them, you see portraits of her, like photographs and paintings, wearing the costumes that are in the case in the middle. Mm. And it just, like, by the time we got there, I really felt, oh my God, she overcame all of this to make of herself this artwork. Mm. And it was incredibly inspiring and you know, distressing. And you just wonder how she sort of mustered that determination.
I find her as a figure really fascinating, because I think, especially over the past few years, there has been this kind of tendency to, you know, on a very kind of basic, shallow level, to think Frida Kahlo, think
style,
for floral headband, you know, think embroidered dress. And I do wonder how many of those people who kind of have been inspired by that look would know that kind of that background to it. I mean, I'm sure plenty do, but it's interesting how she has, in a way, kind of transcended it. I think
it's one thing reading it, and another thing being kind of confronted with these things. Mm. And I think the last time I saw kind of a lot of Frida Kahlo's work was the Tate Modern did that big retrospective that was in 2005, actually,
with pieces from Madonna's personal collection.
You know, that was a huge collection. It was an amazing exhibition. But without the context of this, I think it probably was lacking something. And I think being able to see this and then look at her work, you'd have fresh eyes.
I know, Lisa, you've written making a case against reducing Frida's legacy to a flower crown and an embroidered blouse. But I have to say, I think that she did that so strategically for herself that it's almost admissible. Or permissible, rather.
Well, listen, I'm not saying you can't wear any of those things. I suppose I've got nothing against people wearing whatever they want, but it's the merchandising of it. If I get sent one more email from some naff brand saying, get the Frida look, you know, and it's probably been made by five-year-olds, or maybe it hasn't been made by five-year-olds, but the thing is, it's just crass. Leave it. She can wear that look because she invented that look. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, some of it was taken from her heritage, but she put it through the Frida blender, and that's fine. I just don't want to see it reduced to a get the look.
Do we want to see anything reduced to a get the look?
Not really. But I
don't mind. If something's conceived in utter crassness, then I think I'm very happy to see it buried in utter crassness. But hands off Frida.
Hands off Frida. I mean, at the preview, I did wonder how Frida would have felt about her clothes rather than her work being the focus of an exhibition. She did put so much effort into constructing her self-image, but would she disown that? Would she say, no, you're focusing on the wrong thing? Or would she say, yeah, I'm glad you noticed what I did there?
If only she were here to answer that question.
Well, she might argue that she was her own greatest artwork.
If you haven't booked your tickets to see Frida at the V&A, chances are it's because you've been tethered to your TV watching the World Cup, or more likely, dare I say, Love Island. Charlie, for the uninitiated, can you tell us what it's all about?
Yep, here I am with the lowbrow. Basically, the premise is that young singletons pair up into mostly heterosexual couples, and after 8 weeks sharing beds in a villa in Mallorca, public vote for their favourite couple to win $50,000. The Mediterranean waters are muddied somewhat by the arrival of new singletons at the villa and subsequent recouplings and Big Brother-style evictions for third wheels.
I mean, Why has this become such a sensation?
I must admit, this is my first year watching it. And it's one of the things, I mean, I hated Big Brother. I hated just the whole circus and feeling like people were really being used in that way. And that's what put me off watching Love Island. But then I thought, you know, it's one of those things that so many people are talking about. It's in every paper, in every magazine, in every column at the moment that I'm reading. And I kind of felt a bit silly to be damning it before I'd ever watched it. So I've given it a go.
It's very open-minded of you.
Well, you know, I try. And also I'm not up to that much in the evening. but actually, I'm really enjoying it. There's some lovely human moments in this. And while I completely agree that it does kind of, it does use people to make good TV, but what I think separates this from the likes of Big Brother is they're not given very much to drink. And I think that's really important. So whereas kind of Big Brother used to get, especially, you know, the later seasons, and you'd read those news stories about, you know, wine bottles, etc., that was all alcohol fueled, and they would just give them so much booze and they were really bored and all going a bit stir crazy in this confined space. And I think it's admirable, actually, that the producers haven't gone down that route, and they've tried to, you know, you don't need to put extra drama in there because you've already got the element of romance, which is going to cause all the drama you need.
Isn't it true that that kind of younger generation don't drink as much anyway now? So it would just feel kind of really wrong on so many levels.
But the sad fact is, yeah, Bethan, that you and I are the same age as some of those contestants.
Really?
Yep.
Oh, well, so, and maybe next year we could go on Love Island.
I seem to have missed the non-drinking millennial memo.
Well, I don't understand the show, but it has been on TV when I've been in the room a few
How
times.
Convenient.
I believe, was it your four-year-old twins put it on?
Actually, it was my husband. He's kind of into it. And this being a fashion podcast, I can admit I'm fascinated by the swimwear. Like, it really, you know, I've watched this and just wondered, like, does every swimsuit come with a built-in wedgie now? What is going on with their swimwear?
This is what I found disturbing about it, the swimwear, because I, like you, I thought, Jesus, are they really back? Those buttock-bearing swimsuits. That, for me, is the big block.
I mean, they spend most of their time in swimwear, and they look to me so much more comfortable and at ease in, like, bikinis with weird cheese grater, you know, lacing than in regular clothing. But I don't know, it just makes me long for, like, the purity of a deep V black mayo.
But then that's the joy, because I'm watching it at home in, like, a cashmere sweatshirt and some pajama bottoms, and I've
cashmere.
You know, I've got a wash on, and I'm probably eating some chocolate, and the joy is you're watching these people. I always wondered what it would be to look like that, to have a body like that, kind of what life would be like. And now I can see without ever having to force myself into those kind of...
I mean, what's the alternative? I mean, obviously it would be fabulous if it looked like a kind of live Slim Aaron's photo or something with all the women in, like...
Oh, the ratings would be so much lower, don't you think?
Well, exactly.
Okay, I'm going to come in there on the ratings, because this is the thing. I don't really have a strong opinion either way about Love Island. I have tried to watch it. It's not my thing, but so what? But this idea that we're all being coerced into feeling that we've got to watch it because everyone's watching it, 2 million people out of a population of 60 million. Okay, take away the children. It's after the watershed. But, you know, that is not everybody. And yes, every columnist is writing about it. Why? Because they feel if they don't, they'll look old, or they'll have, you know, they're not tuning into the zeitgeist. So it's yet another of those chimeras that we're creating. I mean, it's not everybody's watching it, not everybody's talking about it. I'm fine with it being on TV. It's great, it's giving some people pleasure, but this idea that we've all got to watch it, otherwise we'll be out of a big national conversation, is just hype, and that annoys
me. Thank you, Lisa.
Me.
I mean, I do feel that there's a lot of, like, cultural consumption is sort of panic-driven. Let's return for a moment to the fashion, because something that I read about this is that the fashion is actually sponsored by kind of a millennial e-tailer. Is that right? Is Misguided behind a lot of the looks for the dates?
Wouldn't surprise me.
I think I've read that they do certain days of the, you know, of the filming, maybe the big evictions or something like that.
I would be really interested to find out, you know, what kind of selling power Love Island has. Like, do they sell out those little kind of shredded lace cohorts that it looks impossible for anyone except those girls to wear?
It's all the pieces that we would see on a sale and go, God, why did they even make that? It's not for us. It's, but I think it's got a huge selling power. I think
we actually did a piece last year about the, you know, I don't know, upticks in the searches for yellow swimming costumes and all that kind of thing, or leopard print after someone had worn it on Love Island. I mean, it's a real thing. These are the people. These are kind of influencers in their own interesting way.
Well, also, they appeal to a fast fashion shopper because they're fast fashion shoppers themselves. You never see these girls wear the same things twice, not even the same swimsuit. You know, and some of them are in there for 8 weeks, but you don't see them repeat anything. They've got a huge arsenal of kind of mini dresses, and it is kind of really statement stuff as well. You know, I saw kind of a Twitter argument going on. When did the kind of rule of either tits or legs die? Because on Love Island, it is tits and legs and a whole lot of everything else.
From high to low and back again, everyone. It's Royal Ascot time. The first day of the annual racing spectacular saw the Queen attend with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, Princess Beatrice and Princess Eugenie. Although we hear there are horses, the event is all about hats, and it's worth an awful lot more than prize money. Bethan, talk us through it.
Yes, the Ascot fashion effect is real. So there was some research done a couple of years ago which said that Ascot is worth £33 million fashion-wise to the economy. But I would wager bet that it's, you know, kind of astronomically beyond that even now. Fenwick have told me that they've had their best year yet for occasion wear and hats, especially in the run-up to Ascot. And Oliver Brown, which is a menswear outfitters, has taken £1 million in Ascot spending, which is just phenomenal. And I mean, you can kind of do the maths yourself. I think there's 13,500 people in the royal enclosure each day. Let's imagine each of them is spending an average of £200 even, which is probably not that much considering some of them spend £7,000. That's like millions.
Well, and there's two other enclosures as well.
Well, three other enclosures.
Yeah. And also, I think there's a huge halo effect in that I think people look at those pictures or, you know, for months. And in fact, if you're going to a wedding or some sort of posh do, you might just hashtag Ascot, and then you see hats and you think, oh, actually, I wouldn't mind wearing a hat. I think the British millinery industry would be a tenth of its size without Ascot.
Yeah, absolutely. They've some departments still say that they wouldn't have a hats department if it wasn't for Ascot. So, I mean, we all kind of, you know, really look forward to looking at those. I don't know, it's so on such a line, isn't it? Those pictures that you see and of those people, you know, and these insanely ostentatious
feathered creations. They're the sort of when you get there.
Yeah.
They're the sort of
the show off.
Yeah, but they're almost like show pony. They're there to sell something usually.
It is fantastic people watching. If you can get one of the very few tables kind of around the champagne tent in that grassy bit of the royal enclosure. Fantastic. You needn't move. You needn't watch a horse.
Yeah. Horses. Also, don't you feel that after quite a long time of being maybe it's a little bit naff or ridiculous, Ascot's become quite fashionable again. And I don't know whether it's the Meghan Markle / Duchess of Cambridge effect, but that way of dressing, you used to feel if you had to go to Ascot. When I was first at the Telegraph and I would get packed off there as a sort of work thing, I almost would feel as though I was wearing fancy dress because it was so different from what was going on in fashion. But now fashion and Ascot, they kind of, there's this a Venn diagram where they're sort of meeting. And we saw that at the royal wedding as well in May. All those beautiful floral long dresses, and you just stick a little hat on with that, and you're ready to go. And that's apart from the hat, that's a fashion look. actually, there were loads of hats at the shows. There were head coverings of every kind, including more traditional hats. I mean, I know in the US, hat wearing isn't such a big thing.
Right. It sort of feels like you said, like I'm in English national costume. And I know I'm sitting in a room with Ascot veterans. I'm about to go for the first time this week. What does a first timer need to know to not feel like Julia Roberts at the polo? And
well, I think it might be nice to feel like Julia Roberts.
I would say don't take one of those frilled umbrellas. Anyone carrying Eliza Doolittle frilled umbrella?
No, bursting into song. And I can't remember the song that they sang in that film when they were at the races, but Get Me to the Church on Time, maybe. No, don't do that.
I shall try.
I think... Also, no, this is weather forecast, because it can be cool, and it's boring if you're cold. So think about your top layer
and comfortable shoes. It's also really boring if your feet hurt, because there's not that many places to sit down unless you're kind of doing one of the big tabled lunches. Mm. Most of the time you're milling around, and you don't want to be one of those women, because you can't get a taxi for love nor money when you come out as well, because they've closed off the whole road. Right. So then you'll have to either walk to the station or, you know, wherever you're getting to.
Definitely. I think as well, if you kind of get dressed in the morning and you're a bit like, oh, is this a bit much? It's not.
No, exactly. Go and throw yourself into it, or don't go. But I know, I've seen part of your outfit, Emily. You're going to be absolutely fine.
I'll show you the rest of it. I have pictures. I mean, my outfit options are a bit limited, given that it's, you know, whatever I can fit into right now, as opposed to, you know, any kind of nipped in little number. But we'll report back and let you know how the whole hat wearing thing goes.
I mean, just a tip as well. If anybody is going to any sort of event where they need a hat, I went to a department store last week to get my Ascot outfit, and they specialize in the whole Ascot thing, event dressing. And so I was able to take my dress from the dress department, which was next door to the hat department, and it was so helpful. It's so much easier than trying to do the whole thing separately or from memory. Oh, I think my dress was that shade of blue. You take your dress along in there, and they put me in a color that I hadn't even envisaged for the hat, and actually it looks so great. And I think you really... Ideally, if you do that, if you're really being serious about this, then you sort of get the whole outfit and piece it together as you go along, not when you get home and think, oh God, it doesn't really go, but never mind. Because, you know, I was just listening to an interview I did with an etiquette specialist the other day. And, you know, the whole thing about these dress codes is they are actually done not to inconvenience you, as I used to think, but to make the event seem more special. And if you kick against that, then you're kicking against the whole event. So why go?
And that's what everyone I spoke to for my piece said as well, is that, you know, dress codes are mostly dead now. You know, you can wear trainers to work. You know, you can make anything work for anything, pretty much. But, you know, when there is a dress code, people... actually love
they
that
do
now
love it. Because also the other thing she said to me was, you know, we were talking about dress codes in general during the season. She was saying at Glyndebourne, that black tie dress code, which is optional, but it was originally introduced as a mark of respect for the performers who were all in black tie. And if you think about it in that way, as a sort of good manners appreciation, it's actually rather lovely, because it's very easy to roll your eyes at all these sort of so-called posh people going along to events in top hats or whatever. Well, if you don't like it, don't go. That's fine. But, you know, if you go, you just have to get into the spirit.
If you'd like to know more about Royal Ascot or the Duchess of Sussex's latest Givenchy couture ensemble, then you know where to look. Visit telegraph.co.uk/fashion, and please email any feedback and questions to unzipped@telegraph.co.uk.
We've been waiting ever so patiently to talk about Ocean's 8. The film stars Sandra Bullock, Kate Blanchett, Anne Hathaway, Rihanna, Helena Bonham Carter, and other illustrious women who play a motley crew of con artists with their eyes on a staggering diamond necklace. Everything that you'll read about this film will call it a heist movie, but we know the truth, and that is, this is a girl power fashion movie of a sort we haven't seen for some time. For so many reasons. Reason number one, the pivotal heist scene is set where? At the Met Gala. Number two, they worked with Cartier. Number three, Anna Wintour makes a cameo in which she makes fun of herself because she's watching tennis.
And 4, one of the main characters is a fashion designer. Finally, 5, Rihanna. Bethan, you've seen it. What does this film get right?
It gets a lot of things right, I think, which will be contrary to a lot of the reviews. Any narrative sagginess is absolutely made up for in incredible costumes and really uplifting storylines. And I think this is one of, obviously, this is a criminal heist film.
I was going to say, aren't they all crooks?
Yes, but do you know, well, yeah.
They're smart crooks.
They're smart. Great. And I actually think that, you know, fashion can really not come out well from films, I often think. You know, it's that whole kind of Devil Wears Prada, you know, it's a bitchy, shallow, horrid industry. And I think maybe this shows, you know, the craftsmanship, the inner workings and intricacies, and in quite a nice way.
The politics. I mean, one of the main plot movers has to do with what's her name? Someone Kluger.
Daphne Kluger.
Thank you, Daphne Kluger. She's the host of the Met Gala, and she gets wind that her society rival might wear a gown by a certain designer. And so, of course, she gets that designer to dress her instead.
And we see then the designer kind of having to delicately massage her ego as she sort of talks about how beautiful her neck is and how incredible she's going to look. And I mean, these are totally things that you can imagine actually happen behind the scenes.
Just an average day in the Telegraph office. No?
I mean, I have to object to the use of the word sagginess having anything to do with Cate Blanchett's like pin sharp wardrobe of
so cool
menswear inspired suiting. I mean, she has these deep V's, she has these like slim cut, you know, Dior Homme style jackets and trousers, and just every time she comes on screen, I just think that she's in a Saint Laurent ad, basically.
It was all inspired by old photos of Keith Richards, apparently, and Debbie Harry.
Makes perfect sense.
Mm.
I was really glad to, I read actually that the opening weekend took more than any of the other Ocean's films. And I was really glad to read that, because I think I'm always a bit nervous when you hear of an all-female kind of, I know it's not a remake, but, you know, that's such a male franchise. And then to be like, oh, we'll just throw in a token women's film rather than cast films with a bit more diversity.
That is kind of what I feel, though. They are still doing it, aren't they? They'll do this film and they think, oh, we've done the women now for a bit.
Well, it's like female Ghostbusters.
Yes.
And it's, do we need an all-female Ghostbusters, or should we just make films with women and men? In lead
just
roles.
Being characters, I mean, together.
If a woman is talking about a man in dialogue, then she's not kind of really a lead character. If she never talks about anything but a man or
the Bechdel test,
exactly. And I kind of think the solution to that isn't just to take men out of films completely and make them all about women, is it?
Well, there are men in this film, although they're definitely peripheral figures. The only quasi-love interest is a cad who they ultimately set up for part of the crime. But I did love in the film when the reason that Sandra Bullock as Debbie Ocean gives for assembling an all-female crew of criminals is people notice men, women are invisible. I'm sorry, Rihanna in that red off-the-shoulder Zac posing
it's
gown.
Hollywood.
It was, I mean, if she's invisible, then, like, people need a new prescription, because it was just...
That's after the crime, though.
That's true, that's afterwards. But, I mean, on what you were saying, Charlie, like, Cate Blanchett actually addressed this. She did an interview on Sky News where she said that there's this unnatural pressure on a film like this, which has all women on the poster, and you go, please, God, do well, because if it doesn't, it's going to reinforce the falsehood that these films don't do well and no one wants to see them, which is untrue. So it's a heavy weight for a frothy film to carry.
I do think it's nice as well that this has thrown up a few issues about body image in them kind of doing the press tour. And Anne Hathaway spoke about when they started filming, she'd just had her baby and she felt like she was a bigger size than she usually was. And nothing wrong with that, but she was aware of it kind of going into filming. And everyone kind of complimented her, and Rihanna said her ass looked great, or I think Rihanna said she had an ass like her, and she kind of then felt
freaked out.
But that was very positive. And there's this whole conversation about Rihanna's body at the moment, and she's kind of said, "Yeah, I have a body that changes size, and I just dress for what looks good at the moment." And actually, those are really rare things to hear. You hear about actresses kind of gaining weight for a role and then trying to get back down again. and it's quite refreshing.
Well, and can I just say, Anne Hathaway has never looked better. She looked bodacious. Like, her wardrobe just consisted almost exclusively of sort of Bardo neckline, you know, V-neck dresses that show her newfound curves, shall we say. They featured prominently in many, many scenes. And I loved her in this. I don't love her in everything, but she just leaned into the divaness of the role and looked like she was having a great time.
I mean, I think it's interesting also that somebody in the film industry was saying to me the other day that people in the UK just don't go to watch movies. And, you know, we're all watching Netflix. And I totally agree with this, but we don't want this sort of just to be ghettoization of women. And OK, we've done our quota for the year. But I think they have created an event movie that you want to go and see in the cinema. You're not, if you want to see this film, you're not just going to wait for it to come out on TV. So I think that that's quite good, and it's great that it's done so well already. Also, this, there is one thing. I mean, I find this, maybe it's just my friends, but if we all go out for dinner with our male partners, we often, like, 10 minutes in, the women will all go and sit at one end of the table. It's just so much more interesting talking to the other women.
I can see this being a real girl gang movie where groups of men and women will go out, and, you know, the men will say, we're going to Jurassic whatever.
Yeah.
The women will say, we're going to Ocean's 8. And, oh, man, if
we'll
this could be Jurassic
We'll meet you for Doritos
Day,
after.
Be, yeah, exactly.
I can offer an immediate solution to cinemas not being very well attended here. Sell better wine.
Well, the everyman.
Exactly. That's why I go to, you know, Screen on the Green. But outside of a London bubble, terrible wine in cinemas. Come on, people.
So my first job was at a movie theater in the States. And I still don't know why we don't have melted butter on popcorn here. I mean, it just makes the world a better place.
Have you seen the popcorn here? It wouldn't melt because it's all cold and stale.
I know, but, like, hot buttered popcorn is one of the joys of going to America, and especially
go
if you
to
put in some peanut
M&M's. Hummus and focaccia.
And a little, like, you know.
They do little platters. It's delicious.
And a little anemic pizza. I know. But I don't want a sofa. I want, like, a big vat of hot buttered popcorn. We have to, like, wipe your hands on, you know,
you
your date shirt.
You can take the girl out of America, honestly.
Do you know what? I'm happy with pick and mix.
Have you seen Ocean's 8? Did it make you want to buy a slim cut suit or take up pickpocketing? Let us know your thoughts by emailing us at unzipped@telegraph.co.uk. And of course, visit telegraph.co.uk/fashion for more on the film. Guys, it's about that time, so let's go around and say what everyone is excited about this week. Charlie, what about you?
I've got two this week, and shockingly, neither of them is TV.
Or food.
One is food, yes. Okay. So firstly, there's a new cookbook out. So I used to live in Clapton in East London, and right around the corner from me was this amazing jam shop called the London Borough of Jam. And it's fantastic. And this woman, Lily O'Brien, makes all her own jams, and she opened the shop at the weekend to sell them. And she's been doing this for years, and she's got her first cookbook out. And it's called Five Seasons of Jam.
Speciality.
Is it all
stores?
Jam?
It's all jam.
Don't pull that
face. I mean, she used
How
to...
How many jams can you make?
Emily,
you really need a whole
so
cookbook?
So many jams, Emily. I used to go in there because she'd make her own donuts and fill them
with
the jam.
Once you've done the donut and the jam on toast and scones, then what?
Just a spoon, if you're me. But she makes these, you know, rhubarb and cardamom and just greengage, plum and fennel pollen.
So greengage is a fruit that I actually thought that my mother-in-law made up to, like, prank me.
No, no one knows what a greengage is.
No, but they're real, and she grows them, and she makes jam out of them. And I really thought for the longest time that it was, like,
different from a gooseberry?
A gooseberry is also made up.
Yeah. I think a greengage is bigger. It's kind of like a, yeah, it's more like a plum. Oh. So when I'm not making jam, though.
Beatrix Potter fruits.
Tomorrow, I'm actually going to a life drawing class with Alexa Coe. So I spoke about her, actually, on this podcast. She's this great young artist who is sold via this website called Partnership Editions, which is now in Liberty. And she's doing a life drawing class tomorrow afternoon that I'm going to. And Partnership Editions do actually set these up, and you can buy tickets on their website.
Is that the girls, the boys?
Exactly.
Event?
So the one tomorrow I'm so going cool. with a brand that we've actually covered in the paper. Mm. But I'm really excited. I haven't done live drawing since I was at art
that
school.
That sounds fabulous. Can you do stick drawings, do you think?
I mean, I was actually terrible at drawing. Shocking at life drawing, but you never know. Maybe I'll have loosened up a bit.
Yes.
Less self-conscious.
Yes.
In my
well, if you take some good wine.
Lisa, what are you excited about this week?
Well, in about 2 hours,
I'm going to the Rolling Stones. I'm a Stones groupie. That I'm very excited about that. And just reading below, you know, all the below the line comments, which is great because you sort of think, oh my God, the Rolling Stones again, really, I should branch out. But the reviews and all the below the line comments from people who've been have just been really great. I think it's so fantastic that they're really still on it musically. Mick's voice is still amazing. And the only thing I've read bad reviews on is the clothes. But frankly, 'twas ever thus. Mick's got terrible taste. And I'm really looking forward to seeing those terrible clothes.
Flamboyant taste.
But there's flamboyant and there's schmamboyant.
Maybe you need to go backstage and help them out, Lisa.
I've got no desire on the Stones, weirdly, in that sense. I love the music. I interviewed Keith Richards once and it was a total disaster.
Oh, no.
I was ill-prepared and he was... Let's put it this way. His PR said to me, it was after 6 p.m. You know, no, you can't do Keith after 6 p.m.
I just thought he'd just be getting going then.
He was horrible to me, but I still love them because they are just the greatest band ever. And my other excitement is last night I went to a dinner for the Modest website and a poet came on. And sadly, I can't remember her name or anything about her other than her poetry was quite seize you by the throat. And Roland Murray was sitting next to me and he said, poetry is the next thing, Lisa, didn't you know? And I thought, I bet it probably is.
Oh, Instagram poets are huge. Yeah.
Well, so I'm so behind the curve on that. So, yeah, I'm booking a poet for my next hen night.
That'll be a big hit. Bethan, what about you?
So mine is TV. The Staircase. Has anyone heard about this? So it's the new...
Got a thumbs up from producer Charlie over there.
So I've seen two episodes so far. It's a case of a woman who, called Kathleen Peterson, who appears to have perhaps fallen down some stairs. And it's all about whether she did or did not fall down the stairs. And her the prime suspect, if she did not in fact fall down the stairs, is her husband Michael, and lots of skeletons are coming out of his closet. And I am absolutely enthralled and would like to be binge watching it right now.
Well, I'm sorry to keep you.
Obviously, I'm excited about my Ascot hat. How is that pronunciation, everyone?
Ascot.
But speaking of skeletons coming out of the closet, what I'm really excited about is Coco. Did anyone see this when it was in cinemas?
No.
Disney Pixar, right?
Yes. It's the Pixar movie about a boy's journey to the land of the dead.
Obviously, I thought you meant the film about Chanel.
Well, I mean, you would, wouldn't you, given the setting and the context. But no, it's not a Chanel film.
I don't even know why I knew. I don't have children.
Well, no, the thing is, it is a kid's movie, but it's quite intense. I wouldn't show it to my 4.5-year-olds. It's about a boy's journey to the land of the dead in search of his ancestors on Dia de los Muertos. And it is so beautiful and it is so earnest. I have to say, I watched it through tears and I haven't been able to stop thinking about it since. And I'm pleased to find that I'm not alone in this. I watched it over the weekend. And then yesterday came across a story that the New Yorker's Gia Tolentino, whose writing I absolutely adore, she wrote about Coco as a millennial sensation, and she suggested that part of the appeal is the idea of a world that is, quote, animated by sweetness and a little something deeper. So to read a little bit of her story, she says, Coco is a movie about borders more than anything. The beauty in their porousness, the absolute pain produced when a border locks you away from your family. The conflict in the story comes from not being able to cross over. The resolution is that love pulls you through to the other side. The thesis of the movie is that families belong together.
That's like Paddington 2, which I watched last week on a plane, and I watched through a haze of tears. And obviously I felt ridiculous, but I read somewhere that you cry more easily at 35,000 feet.
Well, any
who
excuse.
Knew?
I mean, tears are cathartic.
But I highly recommend Paddington as your chaser to Coco.
I've heard that. I've heard that Paddington is, you know, surprisingly good.
But it's also
so watch
about,
Paddington.
It's also about being kind and sweet and love conquering and being nice to immigrants and families.
Well, I think with everything that's going on in America at the moment, with all those families being divided, it's something that needs to be addressed. I mean.
Very
interesting
timely.
To think that this kind of Disney film might be doing that.
It is, and also a great primer before you go to the Frida exhibition because she's actually a character
She's a character in the film who is like the celebrity of the underworld. You know, people actually dress up as her to try to get into exclusive parties and things like that.
So do you know, I think I'm going to have to go against my own dicta and dress as Frida.
For Ascot, why not? Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Check back next week for another episode of Fashion Unzipped.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.